Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Leading Edge Love Radio. This is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach at sumatisparks.com. And today we have as our guest Zach Beach, who is an internationally renowned yoga teacher, a best-selling author, poet, love coach, and the founder of the Heart Center Love School. Zach also leads Power of Love retreats, heart-opening workshops, and transformational teacher trainings, and is also a popular speaker at conferences and college campuses. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thanks so much, Mati. Happy to be here.
So glad to have you. I also want to mention that Zach, one of the transformational workshops that Zach leads is the Learn to Love series based in Oakland, California, where I live. And I will be speaking at one of his events this coming Monday, May 21st, and it's called Open Relationships, Love at Any Age. And I will be speaking about midlife polyamory on a panel of people that will be talking about polyamory at all different ages. So I'm really looking forward to working with you at your event on Monday, Zach. That'll be really fun. I've been to a couple of your other events there. So one as part of your Learn to Love series. So maybe you could start by telling us, we're going to have a love fest tonight because I'm all about love. You're all about love. So how did you get into being a love coach and a love teacher and, you know, all the stuff that you do about love? How did that happen in your life?
Yeah, great question. This wasn't always my career choice, living a path of love. But about almost a decade ago, I was actually working as an engineer for biotech and pharmaceutical companies. And believe it or not, but looking at a computer and sitting in a cubicle all day did not make me very happy. And I decided that life is too short not to do what you love. And when I really looked within and I looked into my own heart, I realized that what I loved was love. And so I quit my job and I decided to completely devote myself to love and to see my purpose in the world as helping others bring more love into their lives and deepen the intimacy in all of their relationships. And as I'm sure you've discovered, and many people have discovered, is that there's many ways to live a life of love. There's many things one can love in life, and then there's many ways one can walk the path of love. So for me, my work in the world, I think of it as being on three levels. The first is the level of the body. So I get to teach yoga every day, and I get to tell people to open up their hearts every day. On the level of the heart, I write poetry and do spoken word performances all around the town. And then on the level of the mind, I write and I research, and then I started the Heart Center Love School, which is an organization designed to help the world bring more love, and which is where Learn to Love comes from.
Awesome. And so tell us a little bit about your background. Did you come from a loving family, or did you have to teach yourself how to engage in a healthy love relationships?
You know, I am extraordinarily lucky. I recently published The 7 Lessons of Love, which we'll talk about. And one of the first people I acknowledge at the very end is my own mother. And we actually hang out on Sunday for Mother's Day. And I feel extraordinarily lucky to have grown up in a loving family. And although I didn't know it at the time, my parents said that when they started to have children, they set the intention to have a household that had unconditional love. And of course, they didn't use these terms when they were talking to me, but it was quite clear that no matter what I did or who I turned out to be, that no matter what, my parents would love me. And in the book that I wrote this idea that we spend the first formative years of our life absorbing love from the people around us and the rest of our lives giving it away. And I feel like very much that has been my path, as I was very fortunate to receive a lot of love as a child. And now I see my life purpose as giving that love away. Now, I also say that I didn't have a perfect childhood because, of course, perfect childhoods don't exist, because our parents are just as much imperfect beings, trying their best, making up things as they go along the way. However, I do feel quite fortunate and lucky to have the upbringing that I did.
Yes, you are fortunate. And so what about people who didn't have love that they could absorb and then give away, if they never really got it? Do you find that they're kind of always seeking that? And is there a way that they can get filled up so they can eventually give it away in their adult years?
Absolutely. It's not hopeless. Every human being is capable of love. Every human being is capable of having a loving relationship that has the intimacy and the sexual fulfillment that they want and desire. And people that didn't quite receive the love that maybe they wanted or deserved as children can absolutely live a life of love for the rest of their lives. It just might require some level of intentional effort. We all have negative patterns, negative conditionings from when we grew up, whether it was given to us through society or culture or teachers or our parents or anyone, you know, who are around us. We absorb all sorts of messages around love, sexuality. Sometimes these messages serve us, sometimes they do not. And as adults, our task is really to examine all the obstacles that prevent us from loving others, including what we were or were not taught as children. And once we undo those obstacles, then the love just flows from our heart. So there's hope for everyone. Human beings are capable of extraordinary transformations, including those who maybe did not have the childhoods that they deserved.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that through your yoga teaching that helps people connect more with the natural vibration of love in their bodies?
Absolutely. You know, we say that the heart is the place of love for a reason, because as much as we love the mind and how useful the mind is, and we live in a very cognitive-centric society where knowledge has brought us extraordinary, you know, scientific advancements, our source of love, of empathy, of understanding, and really of connection to others absolutely lies in the heart. And, you know, for a lot of people, yoga is just a workout, which is awesome because workouts are good for you and they make you feel good and maybe you feel better about your body when it's in shape. But to me, yoga really just offers a whole number of tools for personal transformation, and as well as really just getting in touch with a person, with your own body and your own heart. So for me, meditation is under the realm of yoga, just as eating well and taking care of your body is under the umbrella of yoga. So by loving oneself, getting in touch with oneself, one's own heart, one's own body absolutely can help somebody bring more love into their lives.
Beautiful. And so you say you're a best-selling author. Is the Seven Lessons of Love, is that your book, or do you have more than one book?
That's my first written book. I have a poetry collection. As I mentioned, I love to write poetry, which is another gateway to the heart. That poetry collection is called Drinking Roses on Sunday. I published it about maybe 5 years ago. And I didn't reach, you know, the number one bestseller or anything, but it still holds a special place in my heart. But Seven Lessons of Love recently reached number one in Amazon in a number of categories, and I'm really happy with how the book turned out and also the response I've been getting from folks and how it's really shifted their perspective.
Congratulations. So what are the Seven Lessons of Love?
Yeah, so I don't want to give everything away, but I'll tell you this. To me, the seven lessons of love are truth behind the mystery of love. It's so often and easily love is described as this great ineffable, this mystery that we could never understand, that we just fall into it without any of our control. But really, the seven lessons of love, the culmination of my own decade of research into the heart, into this strange and powerful and amazing and ecstatic force of love. So I think of seven lessons of love as really fundamental principles, fundamental truths about love that we can all use and we can all apply to bring into our lives, into our relationships, to better love ourselves and each other and the world. Mm-hmm. So I really hope my goal with this book was to completely change somebody's life. I wanted somebody to finish the book and then look out the window and realize that their entire life perspective has changed and their heart has never been so full.
And are you getting some reviews saying that that goal has been accomplished?
Yeah, I've definitely gotten some. Even, you know, the first people I marketed it to is my friends. And so I'll even just get like a Facebook message from a friend and it'll say, thank you so much. There's so many synchronicities. You know, we're all, as human beings, we need love. We want love. We appreciate it. We sing of love in our songs and tell of it in our stories. And I often find that underneath almost all the activities that we do for ourselves is really a seeking and a yearning for love. And so we're all on our own love path as human beings. And I find when people read the book, there's so much that they resonate with in terms of what they've been trying to do and what they're trying to do and the struggles that they find in their relationships. You know, a love story is universal, and we are all living our own love stories as best we can. And sometimes it's scary, sometimes it's frightening, sometimes it's ecstatic. And through all that, I really wanted the seven lessons of love to be some guiding principles along this path for those that are maybe disheartened. The tagline for the book is Heart Wisdom for Troubling Times. Now, troubling times could be maybe you just had a breakup and this is the worst time in your life and you've sworn off love forever. Or maybe troubling times is when you're in your relationship and you thought that you were deeply and madly in love and you had found the one, and then now you reach a level of conflict that it seems like the relationship might need to end. And of course, the troubling times that we live in today. It's amazing.
Politically.
You know, we turn on the news, what you guys hear about, you know, and really this is heart wisdom for all of those things.
Great. Fabulous. So I read one of your posts where you talked about how polyamory can save the world, and it's a little bit of a controversial, framing of polyamory, because I've gotten some criticism for the name of my radio show, Leading Edge Love, said that it implies that monogamy is not leading edge, that it's lesser than in some way. And similarly, when you say polyamory can save the world, it's like saying people who choose monogamy are, you know, stuck in an old world model or something. So taking into account that there's some sensitivity around that, how can polyamory save the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally hear the potential criticism, because there is a lot of criticism of, there's a certain segment of like the poly population who will say that like polyamory is the more evolved, it's the better version of being in relationships, and we should all just open up our relationships and whatnot. But I think both you and me are probably in the same camp that, you know, polyamory is not necessarily for everyone. And I might, in terms of how it can save the world, I might view it as a kind of technology, you know, kind of like solar panels. Like I could say solar panels could save the world, because they could, you know, they could, there's all these good things that we could do if we all just got our energy from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of how it can save the world, what I mean, there's two fundamental ways that can happen. One is by restructuring our intimate relationships. So why in the world does the world even need saving? And to me, the world needs saving because we're in a terrible loneliness epidemic. And people are more lonely than they've ever been before. In history, people interact less face-to-face and less socially. And it's really, it's sorrowful to see such a level of disconnection in society. And although we in theory have devices in our pocket and computers that connect us to anyone else in the world, when you actually measure and do research into people's subjective feeling of loneliness, we find the rates to be rising. So it's like, what are we going to do about this? And what's funny is I love to read, you know, academic research and books by academic authors. And so many new books come out, and they're like, we need to rethink our relationships. We need to rethink our social structures. We need to create new paradigms of social relating so that everyone can feel a connection or a sense of connection and belonging in their lives. And then they just leave it at that. Like, they don't mention, like, any possible solutions forward. And I'm kind of like racking my brain a little bit. Like, we have that paradigm. We have the technology. We have the ability. And that ability is, of course, moving from a love model that says you can only be in love and have love with one person at one time, and exploding that and to look at all the myriad of ways that we can love other people in our lives in an intimate way. Mm-hmm. And through that, we can help heal our society by just simply creating more connection in the world. I know lots of people, when I tell them that I'm into love and I work in the field of love, a lot of people say something along the lines of like, oh, I wish I had love in my life, but I haven't been in a relationship in like 2-3 years. And I point out that we have all a total myriad of loving relationships that support us on a day-to-day basis. But the monogamous love model takes all those beautiful loving relationships we can have. We can have friendship love, brotherly love, and we can be in love and love multiple ways, and it reduces it to just one relationship. So when we look at the loneliness epidemic and the increasing disconnection that we have in society, polyamory, open relationships, swinging, relationship anarchy, all of these models create a path forward in healing that disconnection. So that's
right,
the one way polyamory can save the world. And the other way that polyamory can save the world is that polyamory also has so many tools that any relationship can use. And, you know, one thing I love about the polyamory community is how earnest everyone is in trying their absolute best to make it work. Mm-hmm. And you can read all these books. You know, most poly people are like, "Oh, yeah, have you read Ethical Slut? Have you heard of More Than Two? It's the new book and opening up." I don't know many monogamous couples and relationships that go to conferences every other weekend and are reading the latest books and podcasts. And then in that, not only does like the polyamorous communities have a whole knowledge base of how to operate in relationships, how to manage jealousy, how to take responsibility for one's emotions, and the poly communities end up being a little insular, so these tools don't quite get, you know, to the general population. But anybody can use these tools. You can be in a monogamous relationship and jealousy is going to come up, and it's going to help to have tools to deal with your jealousy.
Exactly.
So polyamory not only can heal the disconnection in society, but also give us the tools to do it. So sorry to interrupt, but go ahead.
No, that's okay. I appreciate all that you said. I had so many different thoughts. I was going to say something about relationship anarchy because there are so many different kinds of love relationships that you can have. And every single couple or triad or group that I coach does non-monogamy in their own unique way. There's no one way of doing it, and the conversation is so complex for each person or group of people that I work with because they all have their different needs and desires and images and pictures of what the relationship will look like. And you don't see monogamous couples doing that as often until they're in crisis, and then they finally, you know, usually the woman drags the man into therapy and they're on the verge of breaking up, and sometimes they can make it. But yeah, you're right. Non-monogamous people start reading books right off the bat before they even start, usually.
Right. And that's the lovely thing about it. Like, you know, they say there's as many ways to do polyamory as there are people. And so every relationship that you go into ends up being a negotiation. And in that, people are open up. They talk about their wants, they talk about their needs, they talk about their desires. And for a lot of monogamous people, there isn't even that conversation. people just like assume like all these things are happening. So we're exclusive now, and we're going, you know, up what we call the relationship escalator that we all know about. So clearly we don't have to talk about any of these things. And of course that lack of communication can spell problems for the relationship later on.
Right. And then the other thing I wanted to interject was when you're talking about how polyamory can save the world, there was an article that came out recently about how in India and China, because of their population control policies from the past, you know, decades, there are now, if I guess, I think under the age of 30 or something, there's twice as many men as women. Now, setting aside that this is totally heteronormative. Yeah, so just setting aside that this is totally heteronormative, I read the article and I went, two husbands for every woman, duh. But, you know, nobody talks about that. It's never even mentioned. This article was about what a crisis it is and what are we going to do? And oh my God. And I'm like, two husbands would be great. What woman wouldn't want a couple of husbands?
You know, that's a good point. It reminds me of a couple of things. One, it reminds me of, you know, a lot of academics kind of ask the question, like, how did homosexual and lesbian relationships, like, evolve? You know, if our species evolved to procreate with one another, then how in the world did, you know, say, homosexual people, like, continue in the propagation of the species? And while we don't quite know we don't quite have a 100% answer, but there are many theories along the lines of, well, we evolved for same-sex partnerships whenever there was an imbalance in the genders. Mm-hmm. Or another similar theory is that just when same-sex people like each other, that helps everyone. So it creates a sense of cohesion as the whole. And you're right. I remember reading, I mean, like, China has about 1 billion people, and they're also, you know, they also have some issue, you know, with testing the gender of the baby before it's born. And then if it's female, it ends up getting aborted. And so even like a 1% difference in the other direction ends up being like 30 million people. So I also heard the same thing, that there's like 30 more million men than there are women. And then it's like, well, yeah, that's what happens if, like, the structure of society requires you to pair up every single man with every single woman, and whatever the difference is, and those people are left with a life of singlehood. But when you break out of this, then you can have whatever configurations you want. So yes, those, absolutely, those 30 million you know, single males can tack on to another relationship, and you can have as many triads as you want.
We have a lot of work to do in the world, don't we? So what is your best advice for someone who's just entering into the world of open relationships?
Good question. You know, fortunately, whoever's listening to this podcast is already doing it. My advice for anyone entering into polyamory, entering into open relationships, is to do your homework. I kind of think of it like we gain a lot of understanding of how monogamous relationships work through osmosis. Like, we watch any movie or we see most parents and couples, and we have a general understanding of like how to operate in monogamous relationships. And then when we begin to venture into alternative relationship paradigms, whatever they may be, we have very few role models and very few examples of how those relationships are supposed to be. And as a result, people can feel lost, and people can feel like they don't want to do it. They don't know what to do in certain situations. And fortunately, we have a few decades of history of lots of poly folks who have committed an extraordinarily high number of mistakes, and then they've learned from their mistakes and created a body of wisdom with which to draw from and to help the new generation of people in exploring these alternative relationship paradigms. So, you know, I remember I've been poly for about a decade now. And when I started out, I mean, there was maybe like one or two books, like there was Opening Up and ethical slut, and there was like one podcast, like Poly Weekly. And, you know, I talked to people that were started like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and they're like, we had nothing. We were, you know, making it up as we go along and trying our best to learn from each other. But fortunately now, anyone entering into open relationships, there's so many resources out there. There's a whole number of books you can look at, podcasts you can listen to, as well as online resources. And there's even a few television shows and movies that show what a non-monogamous relationship could potentially look like. So if you're listening to this podcast, good job. You're on the right track. You're entering into a completely new relationship paradigm that you have very few role models and very little experience with. And the best thing to do is to really learn from others who have already walked the path and have some insight and wisdom to be shared.
Right, and that's what I was going to say, was community is so important, because I find when people come to me and they're new to open relationship, they are very closeted. They don't want to tell anybody in their family. They don't want to tell anybody they work with. They don't want their neighbors to know. Oftentimes, they won't even let their children know for a long time. And so they're very isolated, and they feel like they're this outlaw. So I try to get them hooked into communities as soon as possible, so that we have role models. We really need that emotional support so that we don't feel like we're trying to do it in isolation.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. A community support is so important, and it's also really hard, you know, if you're in like middle of nowhere, Missouri, to find anybody who even resonates with such a lifestyle. But I guarantee you there's people out there who would love to talk to you and help you with whatever problems it is that you're going through. I find one of the worst things, like an open or poly person can do is ask a monogamous person for advice.
Right.
Because I find like 9 times out of 10 that advice is like, clearly you shouldn't be in the relationships that you're in. Like the problems that you're in are inherent to your relationship paradigm, and you should break up with boyfriend number 2 so you can be with boyfriend number 1, and then everyone's happy. So it will definitely help to have, you know, people who have that supportive community. I totally agree.
Right. Yeah. Or when you ask a monogamous person for advice, they say, you know, why are you degrading yourself like that?
There's loads of misconceptions. I find even a lot of people, you know, I might even bring up the subject of polyamory, and then a person might be like, what is that? And I'll say, oh, it's multiple intimate relationships with the knowledge and consent of everyone involved. And they say, oh, I could never do that. And I'm like, you just heard about what it is. And a lot of people have already formed an opinion and an understanding of it before you even mention it. And if you're going to talk to somebody about the problems you're encountering, you're just going to get those like sound bites, you know?
Yes. And in the book More Than Two, they talk about if you have the courage to come out to your seemingly monogamous friends, you never know when one of them's going to say, oh, I'm really glad you mentioned that because I have this neighbor that needs someone to talk to, or, you know, I've spoken about polyamory at like straight business conferences. You know, I talk about jealousy and competitiveness in business. And, you know, like you said, the tools that we learn apply to so many different areas. But every time I talk about it in a straight environment, I always have between 1 and 5 people pull me aside in the hallway afterwards and secretly, you know, let's duck into this little dark area here so no one can see me. Hey, by the way, I'm in a polyamorous triad, la, 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 la. You know, there's just a lot of closeted people out there, and it's refreshing if somebody can have the courage to speak about it, and it gives other people permission to start speaking about it too.
No, absolutely. I think you're doing awesome work in the world, Sumati. And, you know, a lot of folks you know, can't come out, you know. They might lose their job. Mm-hmm. They might lose custody
right.
of the kids. And so the more people that can, you know, come out and share their story with, you know, because they know that there's no repercussions like yourself, the better. Because some voices
mm-hmm.
are silenced because they can't speak in this current environment. And,
exactly.
you know, the more people that feel that have the ability to speak out, the better.
Yeah, and we are very blessed where we live, where, you know, many people in our community of sex positive people have to kind of be apologetic if they're monogamous.
It's true.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Leading Edge Love Radio, and this is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach at sumatisparks.com. We're speaking with Zach Beach, the Love Coach, and he's also the founder of the Heart Center Love School and leads all kinds of workshops and transformational trainings on the topics of opening our hearts, loving each other unconditionally, and being in connection and community. So, Zach, tell us what you think, why you think loving more than one person is so hard, and why so many, you know, old pains and triggers come up.
Good question. So, why is loving more than one person so hard? To me, it's two reasons. One is, I remember asking this therapist one time, and along the lines of, you know, everyone loves love. Like, no one, you know, you might not like, you know, even though, like, not many people disagree on, like, a warm, juicy peach. Like, there's people out there that, like, hate peaches, you know. But pretty much everyone is, like, in the same boat that, like, love is this nice thing. You know, 90% of people on this planet are going to get married at some point in their lives. So I was asking this therapist, and I was like, so if people love so much, why don't they love more love? Like, why don't, you know, if people, everyone universally says that one relationship is an amazing thing to have, so why don't they say two relationships is a really good thing to have? And this therapist said, you want to know why people don't want more relationships? Because they're so bad at relationships. And a little tongue-in-cheek, but I know for a lot of people, a relationship, although it is a source of love and connection and belonging and acceptance, it's also a source of stress. It's also a source of many problems. I remember when I was working in the corporate world and I was talking to a coworker, and he said he was working late. And I was like, and I just mentioned, hey, you're working pretty late. And he goes, well, yeah, it's better than being at home with the wife.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, for a lot of folks, relationships are something you work on. It's a source of stress. It's kind of a, you know, it can act as a mirror, which can sometimes be really beautiful. But sometimes that mirror shows somebody their own stuff that they need to work through and they don't really want to. But I definitely don't want to blame the individual person for being quote unquote bad at relationships, because one of the reasons I started the Heart Center Love School is because love schools by and large don't exist, in that we don't have many tools at our disposal of how to have thriving, amazing, intimate relationships. And my vision with the Love School is I want people to learn about love just as much as they did chemistry and physics and history and all those things that we learned for the first 18 years of our life, but we never learned a class on forgiveness or communication or how to, you know, say goodbye to somebody who is on their deathbed. Like, the things that matter most to us in life, the real problems, we are largely left on our own and largely expected to perhaps absorb it at some point when we were children about how to love, and then apply it later on in life. So That's why I think both of us are doing our work in the world to help people along these paths, because, you know, we're kind of left out high and dry in terms of being in relationships. There are a few tools and classes out there. We simply just weren't taught the most critical and essential things about relationships. So on the one hand, you know, loving one person is hard. So Stan Tatkin, he's a couples therapist. I'm a big fan of his work. I recently watched a TED Talk or something along those lines. And he's a couples therapist, and he said, and he works with couples all the time. And he specifically said, being with one other person is the hardest thing any human being ever has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is, again, because we have no tools. But the other part of that is the second reason why loving more than one person is hard, is because intimate relationships will absolutely bring up all of our own stuff. And that stuff, mm-hmm. a lot of the time, is our own childhood wounding, I'll say. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, when we come into this planet as children, we're extraordinarily helpless. We need our primary caregivers to give us the food and water and shelter that we need in order to survive. So to a child, am I loved and will I survive are essentially the same question, because they need somebody to take care of them. And mm-hmm. so the idea of being unloved, of unwanted, is rooted deeply in our survival. So, and that continues when we become adults. And any trauma, any wounding, any hurt, any pain that we had as a child is going to reoccur in our relationships. Now, that's why they're so hard, but that's also why they exist in the first place, because our intimate relationships are the place to heal that wounding, because we're no longer a helpless child, but we're an adult who now has a supportive and loving partner who hopefully is committed to our own growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so being with one person, they're going to be a mirror. They're going to show you all your wounding for your growth, and it's going to be really, really hard. And then being with two people or more than one person not only gives you two mirrors, kind of like when you go into the dressing room, but it also adds that additional challenge of envy and jealousy. So in poly, we say envy is somebody has something that you want. So you're a millionaire, and I wish I was a millionaire, so I'm envious of you. But then jealousy is the fear that somebody is going to take away something that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, you love somebody, and being loved and seen is rooted in these primal fears of being unloved and shame and all these things. And then when you bring more people into the mix, the idea that this third party or fourth party is going to steal this source of love and belonging from your life, which of course brings even more fear. And so earlier I mentioned how important it is to kind of do your homework, because I know a lot of people, they open up their relationship and things are going really well, and then they find themselves crying in the fetal position in the bathroom floor, and they were like, what happened? And those things are going to come up. Opening up your relationship is not going to solve the problems in your relationship. And it will show you those fears and insecurities, that wounding, because they're there. Your childhood wounding that you have is there, and it's going to be with you until you shine light on it, until you heal it, and that's going to come up in your relationships, and so that you can move beyond it. So I know for me personally, when I first got into open relationships and polyamory, is I feel like I grew more in that like first year than I did at any other point in my life.
Right.
You know, people were like, what are your feelings? What are your needs? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm feeling that you're a jerk and I need you to like leave. And, but so much, you know, awareness and self-awareness is needed and necessary. And as a result, once you've grown through that, you know, you end up so much stronger for the better.
Mm-hmm. So if you come from a less than functional household like most of us do, how can you choose an appropriate partner, let alone partners? So many of us have radar for somebody that's just like our screwed up dad or mom, you know, like we can find mm-hmm. that person across a crowded room, you know. So how does one break that so that they can start choosing somebody who will be present with them and do the work that's required to have long-term intimacy?
Yeah, so the answer goes a little bit into what we call attachment theory or attachment styles, which is really a robust area of research around what they call the attachment style that we had as a child that happens, that shows up later on in life in our adult relationships. Now, one thing I want to point out, and I'll just say it to the listeners, is I have yet to see much or any research into attachment styles and open relationships polyamory. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually quite curious if any listener has any resources, any research that shows how these attachment styles affect our relationships, then I'm all ears and send that to me. Now,
well,
from a more
about
like monogamous
that a little bit with,
go ahead.
With one of my guests, Ariel Giaretto, she's a trauma mm-hmm. specialist. We talked mm-hmm. quite a bit about that in the episode with her, so we'll have to collaborate with her on a book.
Good, because I want to see it. And now, so the go-to advice, and I'm not the biggest fan, but here's what a lot of like psychologists will say, is they'll tell you that there's four types of attachment, and they kind of go by different names, but there's secure attachment, which is the one that you want, and then there's anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, and disorganized. And they'll say that the best thing you can do is find somebody who's secure and start dating them. So there's actually a lovely little book. Yeah, right. There's a little book. It's called Attached. It's kind of like the go-to pop side book for attachment theory. And it kind of says that. It says, like, secure people are the best, and they succeed at everything in life. And if you find yourself anxious and you find yourself avoidant, just find the securely attached person, and then their security will just rub off on you, and then you'll be much better. Now, yes, easier said than done, and in a perfect world, that would be lovely if all the secure people just entered into relationships with the anxious people and then taught them how wonderful it was to be secure, because it does take time.
Mm-hmm.
And now for those of us, you know, many of us might find ourselves already in a 5-year relationship with somebody else who is just as anxious as we are, somebody else who is just as avoidant, or it might be in what they call the anxious avoidant dynamic, which is so common to relationships. And for that, there's kind of different routes forward. The idea is that you want to build security. And I feel like you could do that in 3 ways. 1, you could build security with yourself. 2, you could build security with a professional. Or 3, you could build security with your partner. So mm-hmm. being part of a lot of spiritual and meditation communities, a lot of the psychology inclined teachers will actually call meditation spiritual reparenting. And with this idea that, you know, love is getting the attention, the non-judgmental attention from somebody, and guess what? You can do that to yourself. So if you meditate and you give yourself that loving, non-judgmental, non-reactive, like mindful awareness, then you can literally create that sense of security in yourself. So that's one option. And the other option is with professionals. So a therapist is someone you get to see every single week. And they can be that sort of reparenting, if you will. And yes, you're paying them. But guess what? Now you have a person in your life who's committed to your own growth, your own encouragement, and you get to see every week. And of course, everybody is unique, and a therapist is going to have some expertise on helping you work through whatever specific issues you need to work through. And then the third person you could build that relationship with and that sense of security is with your partner. And the idea being that we all have our own stuff to work through, and ideally we have a loving partner who's committed to working it through it with us. So I'm actually am a big fan of, I mentioned before, Stan Tatkin. He has a book called The Relationship RX, or The Relationship Prescription. He has a whole chapter on secure functioning, and he says, here are some things that relationships can do in order to build that secure functioning. So, but you do have to build that up, and you can be with yourself, your professional, or a partner who also is dedicated to the same path and same growth.
Beautiful. I like that you said meditation is a form of spiritual reparenting. I think I did that. I never used that phrase before, but that rings true for me when I took about 5 months off and went out into nature in my RV and just spent all this time alone for about 5 months. And really just broke my attachment to people. Like, I mean, I wasn't completely alone, but, you know, I left my partner at home and said, go do whatever you want. Find as many new lovers as you want. I'm going to be gone. So that, like, broke my dependency on other people.
Wow.
It allowed me to really align with myself and nature. And I was listening to all kinds of spiritual audios and reading books and really getting clear that I'm whole and complete as I am. So I think that that is a really helpful tip. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like for you, it really worked. And I do firmly believe for a lot of people, it will definitely work. Now, there's also a certain segment of people that are just avoidant and avoid commitment, avoid connection. And actually them going off doing things by themselves is a way of running away, you know, from their issues. So
that's a really good point, because I think that I had been more anxious attachment style, and then after that period I have become more what's the other one, the opposite of anxious,
avoidant.
Yeah, so I've become more avoidant since I spent all that time alone. So now I'm like, well, I don't really need people at all. I kind of swung to the other side, I think.
Yeah. But I feel, the way you describe it, I can even sense this, like, level of, like, self-reassurance, like, that is, you know, typical of secure attachment, you know? Like, things are okay, you're okay, we're okay, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah. And we do have to find, like, what works for us. I've just, you know, I'm almost 58 years old, and I've just had a recent discovery that if I don't have sex with somebody, you know, early on in the relationship, if I just flirt and fool around a little and kiss and play, then I leave that experience feeling really full and appreciate them, and I can send them a message. I don't sit there, like, in my, you know, feminine, like, oh, how come they haven't called me? You know, I can call them or leave them a message and say, that was really fun. Thank you for sharing that juicy energy. I'm not needy. I'm very giving. But if I go all the way and have sex with them, then I go into that, like, how come they haven't called me? It's been a week, you know? So I've learned that about myself, like, really recently. God, how long did that take? So now I can go to parties and, you know, play parties and all kinds of things and just stop right before full-on sex and have a great time and not leave feeling empty at all. So the point is that we're always learning about ourselves, no matter how old we are. We're always learning new things and figuring things out. It never ends. It's an ongoing life process.
Oh, yeah. It's an ongoing process, too, because we're always changing, you know. I don't think any of us were the same person we were 5-10 years ago. So that path of self-knowledge and self-awareness is continuous. It's checking in. It's how do I feel now? How do I feel now?
Exactly, yeah. And like you said, when you first started and somebody said to you, you know, what do you want? You know, how do you feel? What do you want? And you're like, what? I don't understand what language you're speaking right now. So, we develop those skills over time.
I know some people say that polyamory is like the PhD of relationships. And while I don't necessarily agree with that assessment, I would say it does require, you know, a knowledge base and a set of skills that many people don't have, and which will require some conscious development, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So since you consider yourself a love coach and your whole life is committed to bringing unconditional love and connection to the world, how would you define the word love?
Oh, beautiful. It's an excellent question. Now, one of the most amazing things about love is it can be so many things. One easy and quick definition that I go to is that love is a genuine concern for another person's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this term because it opens up the possibility of loving more and more people. So if you care about somebody, then you love them. So you love your friends, you love your family, you love your partner. Of course, you love your kids. Like, you want your kids. If you love your kids, you want them to be happy. You want them to be successful in life. You want them to not make the same mistakes that you did. So it can be a genuine concern for another person's well-being. And I think for a lot of people, the first time they realize that is the first time they fall in love, in which case love becomes the first time you care more about somebody else than you do about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that to also emphasize, sometimes love is like a paradox. Like, what do you mean it's loving somebody more than yourself? And it's just a genuine concern for another person's well-being, because at different contexts in our lives, love can take on different meanings. And when we bring love into our lives, we are changed and we are transformed. So I think a lot of us, we go through our lives very self-centered. You know, we spend 99.9% of our lives concerned about ourselves. Am I going to get enough sleep? Am I going to eat? Like, is this going to make me happy? And sort of, you know, we think about ourselves. And then that first feeling of falling in love is that first time, like, another person in this universe has become real, and the first time you care about somebody else more than yourself. And if we look at love in this way, then love becomes like a total dissolving of the ego. Where suddenly, you know, when you look into your child's eyes, when you look into your lover's eyes, suddenly, like, who you think you are totally dissolves away, and the only thing that is left is love. So, a third definition of love, of which I could come up with many, but a third one is simply that love is who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we say namaste, like, the love and light in me honors the love and light in you. And when we strip away our egos and we strip away all the superficialities, and underneath it all, the fundamental nature of our being is that of love.
Mm. Yes. Beautiful. Thank you so much for that. So we're almost out of time, but in the last few minutes, what are some of your best pearls of wisdom for people who might be having problems or struggles in their relationship right now? What can they do to improve things in the immediate future?
Pearls of wisdom for those having troubles. First, I'll say you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I know any time that we're suffering, our world becomes so small. You know, we get sick, you know, even we have a cold, and we're, you know, woe is me. My life is terrible. I shouldn't be sick. I can't be sick. You know, I have to take care of everyone. And whatever problems we encounter in life are universal. And whatever problems you're encountering in your relationship, other relationships, many other relationships are experiencing this exact same thing. And countless other relationships have experienced the same thing and gotten through it. So before your world crunches and this single problem becomes a source of suffering for you, I encourage you to realize that challenges, pain, problems in life are part of the human condition, that we all go through them, and quite frank, and that you're not alone in whatever it is that you're going through. And the next thing that I'll say for anyone going through problems is, what do you like about your partner? So studies show that partners in successful relationships deeply understand that their partner is a fundamentally good person and they're trying their best. Mm-hmm. So if you come home and like your partner slams the door, you don't think, wow, what an insensitive and rude person. Because nobody wants to be with an insensitive and rude person. And once you've like labeled a person in that way, then of course it's going to spell disaster for the relationship. But partners in successful relationships know that their partner is good. So if they come home and slam the door, we think, oh, wow, they must have had a really stressful day. And we attribute, negative behaviors to external circumstances. Stressful day, you know, tough life, they must be going through a lot. And when we know our partner is fundamentally good, then we'll always see the good in them. And what's important in any relationship is gratitude, is appreciation, is it's almost like a love hack, which is you, even if you're having the most complicated argument in your life, you could even say, you know what, you drive me crazy sometimes, but I love you. You know, mm-hmm. I'm so angry right now, but I'm still lucky to have you in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And even just like a joke is a beautiful way to dispel an argument. And some couples relationship therapists recommend is literally like, if you have a problem, wrap a tourniquet around it, take a 5-minute break, come back and express a few words of appreciation for your partner. And realize
that. Thank you so much.
I'll say one more thing is one mantra I like is our relationship important than the problem.
Beautiful. I'm going to have to stop you there because we're almost out of time and I want to make sure we have enough time for you to tell people how to reach you. So thank you so much for being on the show, Zach. You truly are a love expert and I really enjoyed hearing your thoughts about this. So we have a couple minutes for you to share with people how they can reach you if they'd like to know more about all your offerings. And I believe you also have a gift for our listeners. So take it away. You have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I can't believe an hour has passed. It's been so quick.
I know.
So I like to say I'm very easily stalkable. So my name is Zach Beach, Z-A-C-H, B-E-A-C-H, Beach, like Miami Beach, like you walk on a beach. So you can find me at ZachBeach.com, and you can find me at Zach Beach Love on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So Google me, there's a contact form. I love hearing about whatever the latest research or insight. You want to shoot me a line, just tell me about what's going on in your relationship. I'm more than happy to hear. And then for any listeners in the Bay Area, whether you're in Oakland or Emeryville or Berkeley or San Francisco, I encourage you to check out the Heart Center and come to Learn to Love on Monday. So about 6 days from now, Learn to Love, Sumati, along with 3 other speakers, including Kathy Labriola, the author of Love and Abundance and the Jealousy Workbook, is going to be there. We're going to have 4 amazing speakers presenting their best wisdom on love and open relationships throughout the lifetime. And you can use the code ILOVESUMATI for $5 off the ticket price. So I love, and then you should know how to spell Sumati, but it's S-U-M-A-T-I. I love Sumati, gives you $5 off the purchase price. And, of course, we always need volunteers for our events. So if you want to come to any of our events for free, shoot me a line. I can give you something to do, and you can attend and learn from some awesome wisdom holders about what it takes to have an awesome, amazing, and thriving relationship.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Zach. We do have to go. I really appreciate you being on the show, and I have you back in a few months again because we have so much to talk about. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. So next week on Leading Edge Love Radio, we'll be speaking with Alieda Hines. Alieda, she's originally from South America. Now she lives in North Carolina, and she is a clinical sexologist, and she has an upcoming book called The 7 Secrets Seven Sex Secrets. So please tune in next week at 6 p.m. Pacific time to learn what the seven sex secrets are. All right. Have a great evening, everybody. Take care.